A lot of ability in one person today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Shelley Moore Guy is a poet and an author, among other talents. She's also today's guest on Scribble.
Shelley, it's nice to see you again. I haven't seen you for a few years, but I've followed your exploits, and they're as explosive as ever. I can remember way back when you literally exploded onto the poetry scene. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. To your surprise, I think, as much as our surprise, right? Can you tell us how you became a poet?
Well, it's a crazy story, and it may be familiar to some people. Let me first say it's really good to see the both of you again. It's been a long time. Well, I grew up with a brother who is 6 years older than me, my brother Michael. And he was just a fantastic role model in terms of he was always reading, he was always writing, he was reciting in our apartments, you know, as we grew up and then grew up in our family home. But I admired him, and I admired other poets, but at, you know, 6 years younger, when you're 10 years old and that person is 16 and writing, and then given the poets that we were introduced to and when we were younger, there wasn't very much relevance, you know, in just in terms of what I could relate to. So I never really thought that I could be a writer, but I always felt that I had it in me, even as I grew up to go to high school. And but there was something that was compelling me to write. I had taken a class at Blackhawk College, a speech class, and Dr. Harold Ramey, I believe his name was the instructor, the professor. And I was afraid, if you can believe it, I was afraid of this speech class. I hadn't spoken in front of groups before. And I was afraid of him, you know. He seemed stern, you know. And but the very first assignment was that we were to go and find some reading, some writings that we admired, something that we could share with the class. I mean, we could write it ourselves as well. I hadn't started writing poetry yet. But that was our first assignment. And I went to the Blackhawk Library and found books or poetry by Maya Angelou and Nikki Giovanni. And I was 24, maybe 25, and I had never read this poetry before. And it spoke to me. And what it was saying was that I could write something that was relevant to my life, because that's how they were writing. They were writing about their own experiences. And so I could do that as well. I found two poems to share with the class, Phenomenal Woman and Still I Rise, which also just blew me away, those writings, those poems. And I started scribbling. I was living in the Arsenal Courts with my four children, and I started scribbling. And I kept scribbling. I kept sharing with my friends, and they were very, very encouraging, very proud of me. My brother, at one time, after I'd started writing, maybe about a year, he moved in with me, the one who is Michael, 6 years older than I, and we're both grown now. And he was proud of me for writing, because I was writing. And yeah, I was, you know, it was mediocre stuff. You know, I have most of it. I've kept most of it. However, he found a way to keep me writing. Michael did. He always found something to say that kept me going. And I remember one of those sentences of encouragement he said to me, and never forgotten it. He said, "You have a flair for writing the last line." And I don't know if I did or not, but he said I did. And so I kept writing so I could get to that last line and write something profound, you know. And so, but anyway, I don't remember anything else that he told me in terms of encouragement, but I remember that. And I think he knew what he was doing, you know. I do believe that.
Was it strictly poetry that you were writing?
It was poetry, a prose. I couldn't rhyme, you know. That's not what I was doing. I was patterning my writings after my sheroes, mm-hmm. Maya Angelou and Nikki Giovanni, and that's not what they were doing. You know, they were writing, mm-hmm. Writing significant stories, poetries about their lives, with children, with men, with the world, racism and sexism, and they were writing, and so I just kept reading them and others like them, and I realized though that my poems were about mostly a lot about family, and you know. And so they were more poem stories than what I would now look back and call poetry. I was writing stories about my life.
But it didn't take long for you to get published, did you? I remember you.
Well, let's see. I was attending college at Marycrest at some point, and there was a little publication that they had at Marycrest, and it was during Black History Month, and a couple of those my pieces were published in that little publication. I think that might have been one of the first times. And then I entered some contests, the Mississippi Valley poetry
contest. Yeah,
poetry contest. I entered some of those contests and won. Yeah. But it was, I think it was 1983, because my friends knew I was writing poetry, but I, you know, wasn't really 83, 84, wasn't really announcing it to the world. I didn't want to call myself a poet. I was too afraid to do that. And I decided that I would wait until I wrote a piece that I admired just as much as I admired anyone else's, a famous poet's words. And I did. I wrote something called The Experts Say in 1983 or 84. And I had to admit, I was reluctant, but I wrote it. And I had to admit, you're a poet. What are you doing? And I had to do that.
Do you have that handy to read?
I think I know it by heart.
Well, okay, let's hear it.
Only because it was that poem.
Right.
Let's see if I can. It's called The Experts Say. The experts say we stagnate over across the tracks, where garbage grows instead of grass, addictive herbs and children run wild, and so many ambitions die. But I believe that roots survive the aftermath of battles here, where old Ma Betty lives. She knows folks down home who look like me. I see her smiling face among debris they say destroys us. And I know what she and others know, who cross the lines to mow the lawns, leave their own to care for the children of these experts, and scrub angry floors for women whose faces shine like waxed glass. A look inside reveals piano lessons alone will not save us. Roots survive.
I would guess that's a poet. That is incredible.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. That. What led you to do a children's book?
Well, so I, you know, through the years I evolved, I decided that I was going to be a storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I made this declaration and I started reading African folk tales and then reciting them and sharing them with children, along with the poetry. At in 1997 or 98, I was introduced to Bill Bell. Bill is a wonderful musician who was born and raised in East Moline, Watertown neighborhood. I have some friends who were bringing him, as they did, bringing Bill back to the Quad Cities. Bill was a person who, although he lived in California, taught in California, and played all over the world, he came back to visit very frequently. He still had family in East Moline and the Quad Cities, and he would come and perform, you know. And so in 1997, 98, some friends of mine, their organization was bringing Bill back for a weekend performance, and they asked me if I could please write a poem for the occasion that I could recite on those that Friday and Saturday he was appearing at the old Capri Theater. They had turned it into a performance space. And I said, sure. And they wanted the poem to focus on, you know, what it is to be at home, to come from a place, you know, the place where you're from. And I said, sure. But Bill came in a few months before this performance, and I met him. I had a radio show at the time at KLA, and I interviewed Bill. During that time, I had lunch with him. We talked. I kind of got to know him a little bit. And he talked so much about growing up in East Moline, growing up in this little neighborhood called Watertown, and how the people and the experiences, the places raised him to become this man and this musician who he eventually became. This jazz professor, they called him. Bill had was raised in East Moline, Watertown, East Moline. He graduated from United Township High School. He graduated from Augustana College. He graduated from the University of Iowa, became a teacher and of music. Eventually settled in California and taught in colleges. But he always came back. He attributed everything that he had become to this place, to the Quad Cities, to East Moline. And he wanted to be an example of what was possible, especially for kids. And so I envisioned, from the time I spent with him, I wasn't inspired to write a poem, but I was inspired to write this story. So I wrote this story because I envisioned this little kid walking around neighborhoods, you know, mm-hmm. where everybody knew his name and everybody encouraged him, and, you know, sights and sounds. And I wrote the story after I met him. But I didn't write it to publish it. I wrote it to perform it, you know, yeah. which I have done in the last 20 years. That's what I've done. But during the last 5 to 10 years, I thought we should try to get it published because it deserves publication.
Where'd you find the illustrator?
Well, the illustrator is a young man who I met years ago when he was growing up in Rock Island. He's 40 years old, so he's a few years younger than my kids. But I knew him, knew his family. But 2 years ago, I belong to an organization called Polyrhythms, and we present live jazz. We've done that for the last 16 years at the Redstone Room, Third Sunday Jazz. But 6 years ago, we created the Bill Bell Jazz and Heritage Festival in Rock Island. Mm-hmm. Two summers ago, and it's always the third weekend of August. But two summers ago, we decided that we would feature live artists who would paint during one of the jazz sets. And Marshall was one of the Marshall Pass, who was the illustrator of the book. He was one of those three. I met up with him again after years and years. He and his wife had owned a small art gallery in Davenport. So I ran into him there. He was teaching art classes for kids as well. I decided to take my grandson over too. And I got serious in my mind about publishing this book. I didn't know where I was going to find money. I didn't know who was going to publish it, but I thought, you know, it could happen. And I asked him one day if he would consider illustrating. And he'd never done that before either. And he decided, yes, he would do that. And we partnered up, and this is the result.
I'm curious about this. You mentioned that it was partly fiction. And the Uncle Ferdinand, was that his uncle or your uncle?
My uncle.
And you put him in the story.
I put him right on the first page of the story. When I sat down, I remember sitting down to write it. The very first line, Little Billy's Uncle Ferdinand used to play music with his hands. Because I had an Uncle Ferdinand Bynum. And when we were kids, and I was a little kid, we always had music in the house. It was jazz and blues and gospel and country, you name it. There was radio and record players. And Uncle Ferdinand, I don't believe, played a musical instrument, but he admired this music. And I remember him standing up and he'd be listening to jazz, and he would move his hands like he was playing the trumpet or something, or what's that thing that goes in
trombone.
And out, trombone. Or he'd make sounds like a musical instrument. But one of the things he also did was he played his hands on tables. Uh-huh. You know, he would just knock and beat on tables. And he showed us how to do that. He showed us how to keep rhythm and make our own rhythm, really.
Yeah.
And then he did the ham bone that you've seen. You know what the ham bone is.
Yeah.
Playing your hands on your body. And he did that. And his name and that memory jumped out at me on that first line. I didn't even have a choice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I wondered.
I wanted to honor him in that way. Why not?
Well, it works. It works really well.
Thank you.
It's quite a colorful book, and it carries the story very nicely. How did you get it published?
Well, I went to visit during that time when I thought, I don't really know what I'm doing, but somebody does. I decided to speak with Ryan Collins at the Midwest Writing Center, which I've known Ryan for a while. And I sat down with him and I said, this is my story. I have a story. I think it should be published. I have no idea how to make that happen. And so we talked, we caught up and talked for a long time. I told him about the story, and it just so happened that they were actually looking for a project such as this, the Midwest Writing Center, because, you know, they small independent press, they, publish work, poems and stories, whatever. And, I just kind of fell into it.
Mm.
Isn't that something?
I want to shift gears a little before we run out of time.
Yeah, we're close. Go ahead.
Are we really?
You not only wrote poetry, but rather than getting in your little garret and writing more poems,
you reached out to empower other young women to write through poetry, right? I mean, W.H. Auden has a famous statement about poetry in which he says, poetry makes nothing happen. You don't believe a word of that, do you?
I don't. Yeah. Well, you know, when I think it was the year was like 1991, 92. When I started writing poetry, I just, when I became confident, right. I just started sharing it. You know, I started sharing it with my friends
but getting
and
others
neighbors
to do it
and yes, and I did. I worked with a group of high school students at, all coming from Rock Island High School. And they named themselves the Tribal Team Poets and Black Art Collage. Do you remember?
Mm-hmm.
And they were high school students that I had been working with. They were mentors, and I was supervising them. And I just felt like I knew that some of them were writing poetry. But they were, like me, at the beginning, not showing a lot of people. You know, I always say they were writing in a closet. And so I started meeting with some of them, and we created this group. It was magical because not only were they writing, we decided, I convinced them that, you know, let's have poetry readings. Let's share. And we partnered with the Rock Island Library for a time. And we went all over the Quad Cities and a couple of other places and shared their poetry. The confidence that they gained, not just as writers, but as young people who belong to this, they felt that they belong to the larger community.
Does poetry have a special place in that, or could it be any piece of writing or playing an instrument or anything?
I think poetry has its own place in that. And that is because these young people were speaking, as you do, as you're writing poetry, from the heart. And they trusted the adults, myself and a few other adults who were encouraging them. They trusted that it would be okay to write their feelings and their experiences. And to be able to then write it. But then the next step is, you think I can share this with the people I don't know? And people that they didn't know came to hear poems by people that they, that, you know, were not known. And I told them that that would happen. They said, who's going to come? I said, you're going to be shocked with the people who are going to show up and follow. These people followed them everywhere. The other part of that was that there was an immediate gratification that came from that, and that the people who supported them and came to listen to their words also lived in their community. And they may have lived in Rock Island or Davenport or East Moline, but they could go somewhere, go someplace, and somebody would stop and say, aren't you a Tribal Team Poet? Just based on the fact that they had attended a poetry reading. And so that gave them an instant connection to the larger community, who, you know, sometimes when you're younger, you don't know how you fit. And that gave, I believe that had given them a sense of place and purpose, that they belong to this bigger, larger community.
What happens when you write something down? How does it change anything? The fact that it's in your mind, and maybe you've spoken it, but then you write it down. What change does that bring about?
Well, I'll give you an example of one of the young people. I can't find his poem. I kept copies of a lot of their poems. Bradney Haynes is his name. And he wrote a poem that the one line that I kept, that I remember is, "But I keep getting up." The poem was about the negative things that he had been experiencing throughout his life or throughout whatever, something that, "But I keep getting up." That was a reoccurring line. I keep getting up and I keep getting up. And how that changed him to be able to share it, but also how it changed people in the audience, how it changed me. Mm-hmm. Listening, I just thought it was just magnificent that he could say that, and it was so poetic. But there are going to be people in the audience who are going to be listening, and they're going to be able to relate to what you're saying. When I write a poem, the first poem that I shared with you, people who understood, people who came from where I came from, understood. The experts say we stagnate over across the tracks. Well, where is over across the tracks? It's in my world, it's in the West End, and people judge you based on where you live at. Sometimes those are the experts, but roots survive. And so there's a sense of, I wrote it and gained a sense of empowerment. And I think people who read it or hear it, who can relate to it, hopefully will feel a sense of power that no, you know, it doesn't even matter where you come from. It doesn't even have to be. The other side of the tracks doesn't even have to be in the lower end of town. It could be something else that you're dealing with, that somebody might judge you because of. But hearing some certain words will, in a certain time and melody, may make you feel, I can overcome that. I'm okay. I can overcome that. Because somebody else is overcoming it as well.
You know, I used to spend my summers in Greenwood, Mississippi when I was young. Most racially divided town, I think, in the world. And I remember looking around at the black people I had met, and I thought, why are these people being wasted? There's so much solidity in their character. Mm-hmm. There's so much integrity here. Why don't you give them a chance? In education, in employment, mm-hmm. in almost anything. Because if you do, you unleash all this energy and all this ability. Mm-hmm. And everybody benefits from
Did
it.
Did you ask them that?
No. As a kid, I was afraid to ask anybody anything.
Yeah. Oh, you were a kid then.
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. I was a kid. But I remember mm-hmm. thinking that. Mm-hmm. I remember thinking, this is wrong. This mm-hmm. is just crazy. Because the people I met and got to know in the black community, the woman who worked in our house would take me to church with her on Sundays. And I was the only white face in that congregation, you know. And I looked around and I thought, boy, you know, what a place to be. Mm-hmm. It's nothing like my church. Mm-hmm. And there was just such a vitality and the seriousness with which they approached their religion and everything. I thought, man, we are wasting so much. But that is good. Mm-hmm.
But I would say it wasn't wasted. Those kinds of, that kind of vitality, even though the larger world may not have been experienced, or the larger Greenwood may not have been experiencing it, they were passing it on in those church pews and those neighborhoods, much like Bill Bell's experiences. So lots of people would benefit from that, not entirely wasted.
Well, we benefited from this visit. I want to thank you very much, Shelley Moore Guy, for talking with us today. Keep writing, and your little book on Bill Bell, How He Learned to Play Music,
yes,
is worth the time.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for today. I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. We'll be back with you next week for another Scribble and hope to enjoy your company then.